Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I am Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin, Kirk Fancher, and Chris Stewart. And we are going to talk about a great topic for today. Of course, at Global Security Review, which is a publication of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, there's a great article that just came out by Amit Gupta, one of our fellows. And the article's called, Is Trump Right About Europe? And of course, the discussion is, it sort of regards this idea of the special relationship that the United States has with NATO member states and with Europe in general. And Amit poses this question, is this relationship going to decline? And one of the big things that he talks about is that the demographics in the United States are shifting. And they're shifting from a population that is, you know, ethnically European to one that is not. And he posits that the preference for NATO and Europe will decline as the majority of Americans hail from Latin America, Asia, and other places. And he offers the example of the current, you know, somewhat surprising for many, support of the Palestinian cause as you know, and that's sort of caught a lot of Americans off guard. And he says, well, hey, in part, this is you're seeing more black and brown people in the United States be supportive of the Palestinians as opposed to the Israelis. And that this is sort of an exemplar of the change that's going on in American demographics. And so therefore, expect fewer Americans to support NATO. And of course, as President Trump has complained, NATO member states are not spending the 2% required. And so therefore, you should expect Americans to see that as problematic and more Americans to think that President Trump is right and that they should, those member states should spend more. And so it's a very interesting argument, and it's, you know, it's sort of an interesting take on a much broader topic. And so that's what the podcast today delves into, is this idea of what of the future of NATO, the special relationship, and America's role in Europe and the world. With that, let me turn it over to you, Curtis, and sort of throw your first grenade on, you know, into the, you know, throw it out there for the group to discuss.
Well, thanks, Adam. Good to see you again, and Kirk and Chris, good to see you both as well. I appreciate it. I've been away for a couple of episodes here, so I'm happy to be back here. Well, this is an interesting one because it's so politically connected right now. And when we think about NATO, you know, we think about alliance and cost and Article 5 and defense and these sorts of things. But really what I find most valuable about NATO is that it is the collective deterrent that it is, right? So the collective together forms this fear that the you know, to I guess borrow from Aristotle, right, the sum of the greater than our individual parts. And I think what we're looking at here is a question about, do we have enough deterrent? Are we paying for enough deterrent? And we mix this in with American politics, which is always exciting. And we have some, you know, campaign rhetoric going on and a lot of people getting excited about some of these things. And I found Amit's article interesting. I'm not sure I'm going to follow through on the argument that as the nation gets less Euro ethnic centric, that it will care less about Europe. I'm not sure that's something that I would necessarily subscribe to at this time. But what I do want to argue in the sense is that NATO does have to figure out what its life is going to be with regard to varying levels of American support, and that can vary politically. There was a recent piece that came out here that the Germans, it was just last week, that the Germans are talking about perhaps we need nuclear weapons because we can't count on American nuclear deterrence to come to our support or to provide our defense. I mean, it was just pretty blatant, and maybe even an outright fear that if President Trump were reelected, that this somehow would manifest. And this is a real interesting reaction to such a thing. The idea that a nation that eschews nuclear energy is interested in considering nuclear weapons to counteract a political point of merely trying to motivate participation that was agreed upon by NATO countries in 2014 that all would subscribe at 2%. And I think that herein comes to the challenge is that if NATO is important to NATO countries, then NATO countries should be paying quote unquote their fair share, right? And that is not a Trumpian idea. That is an idea that has been echoed in the Biden administration, and that is an idea that has been carried forth originally from the Obama administration. President Obama himself, many complaints about quote unquote free riders in Europe, and so this is a long argument. And the fact that NATO has been deaf on this for many years, even after the initial invasion of Crimea in 2014, I think says a lot.
Chris, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, thanks. It's good to be with everyone. Curtis, I agree with almost everything you said. In fact, probably everything you said. I enjoyed the article, and I learned some things from the article. And I agreed with the conclusions of the article broadly, although not for the same reasons that the author, at least not all of the same reasons that the author put forward. Like you, Curtis, I'm not persuaded that the demographics of the nation are going to weaken our commitment to NATO. And I think a pretty fair example of that is, you know, the Asian population inside America has always been fairly diminutive. It hasn't been a very vocal group either. And yet we're committed and we've proven our commitment to the protection of our partners in Asia. So I'm just not sure that's a very good litmus test. There's a couple of things that I think are really worth mentioning here. And again, Adam and Curtis, you both have either addressed this or maybe I'll just add to it a little bit. Number one is the NATO-US partnership is a partnership. We're not on the European continent. We're outside of that. We have our protections, which that affords us. And yet we were willing to put hand across the pond and say, NATO or our European allies, we want to partner with you. We want to be an integral part of your defense. But in order for that partnership to work, the partners have to be equally yoked. And they just simply haven't been. And the American people became aware of that. I mean, when the American people know that, you know, we're begging our NATO partners to spend 2%, and most of them are not reaching that goal, and including the most wealthy nations in Europe are not reaching that goal. And then they look at the money we're spending, which isn't quite twice as much as our GDP, but it's close. A lot of Americans look at that and go, that doesn't seem fair. Another really good example, really easy example, is the amount of money that we've contributed to the defense of Ukraine. This is Europe's backyard. Sure. I mean, this should be, NATO should be leading on this. The EU should be leading on this. And yet, when you look at the contributions last I saw, which is probably several months old, but it's pretty close still, America was about $123 billion, and all of the EU is about $27 billion. And the American people look at that and they go, I'm not sure that's fair. And I think that's the sentiment that Trump kind of tied into, that he was able to understand and convey. And that is, hey, we want to be aligned with NATO. We want to help you, but it's got to be equal sharing. And by the way, I 100% agree with that. And I'd been to the White House many times, had conversations about this many times. And I can promise you or anyone else, President Trump never wanted to weaken NATO. He didn't want to disengage from NATO. He simply wanted for NATO to pay their fair share. And by the way, why did he want that? Because NATO would be stronger. NATO would be better able to defend against Russian aggression if the NATO partners did what they had committed to do, but they weren't doing it this time. And last thought, I mean, some of the things that President Trump says about this, I mean, this last comment, for example, well, you know, you can do whatever the hell you want with an attack, a NATO partner who's not meeting their dues. I mean, it's a really good example of, I think, unfortunate wording, but it's one of those times where a lot of people who understand the president and support him, they take him seriously, but not literally. They know that he literally didn't mean you can attack these other nations, but they take seriously the message about, hey, you guys should contribute to your own defense. Whereas his detractors, they take him literally, but not seriously. I mean, they take every tweet and every comment he's ever said and take it literally, and it's the end of the world, but they never took his policies seriously. Yeah. And I think his framing of our relationship with NATO is a good example of that.
Yeah, I like that idea of literally and seriously. It's sort of a good dichotomy to think through. Kirk, you've been quiet, but I know this was a topic you were passionate about. So
I am. I want to first kind of piggyback on the demographic argument, which I agree with the consensus here. The demographics in Europe are changing too, and they're changing very much along a similar line. Maybe they don't have quite the growth in their Hispanic population, but they're seeing a lot of immigration from Africa, the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and stuff like that. So global demographics are changing, and I don't think that the U.S. versus Europe demographics are going to be all that different from each other that it would precipitate some sort of different consensus within the country about our biggest economic ally and trading partner. Because that's, you know, the bottom line is really the two big economies in the world, at least the two big democratic economies in the world, are the United States and the European Union. And we're going to be tied economically there, which brings me to my other point, which, you know, as I spoke with you guys both, I did a lot of research on this back in the mid-2000s when I was at the Navy War College. This has been a deficit of investment since then. And it's not just NATO. It was Japan was at 1.2%. And why is that important? It's because, you know, the United States is investing in the global commons. And all economic countries benefit from the global commons. They benefit from combating piracy in the along the Horn of Africa and in the Straits of Malacca. All right, and the United States has been carrying that burden. We're just asking NATO to step up and pull their weight in Europe. We're not asking them to spread themselves as widely as we've been spread. And then, you know, lastly, on an economic thing, it's interesting to me, if you look at the numbers that they spend on social programs by country look at that in relationship to the defense spending, you see that effectively the United States has subsidized European social programs to the tune of between 10 and 20% by stepping up and paying their share of the defense bill so those funds become fungible and they can use them in that. So when you look, you know, the key thing is the only country in Europe that spends less on social programs than us is the UK, which is one of the few countries that are making their 2% goal. So, you know, it's really about, we're not just subsidizing their defense, we're subsidizing their way of life as well. And it's not just Europe, it's the entire globe. You can make this argument around the globe that the United States has been disproportionately securing the global commons for the democracies of the world. And everybody needs to step up, whether that's NATO or Japan or Australia or Canada.
You know, Kurt, if I could, Adam, just jump in on something Kurt said that I think is very important. If you talk about the 2%, I mean, that's generally the conversation we have, you know, the 2% of GDP. It's an easy measuring stick. And it's become the one that's most active in the political arena. But it's important to recognize it's not the only measuring stick, and the other measuring sticks are even worse. I mean, for example, Germany has cut its forces since 1972 by about a sixth. I mean, one sixth of the size of the military. You know, Italy's cut theirs by two thirds. You go down the list of NATO countries, and not only are they not spending, you know, their commitments on military, but it's nearly impossible for them to now, because they've cut their military so much, and they don't have conscription, and they're having trouble, like the United States, but even more so, they're having trouble convincing young people to join the military. So their entire culture has really divested from this idea that we should defend our own nation. I mean, a country the size of Germany with a military of about 62,000 people is all. I mean, that's not a serious deterrent force, and they know that. So, I mean, the problem is actually very deep in these countries, and it's not just a matter of saying, well, we'll adjust the budget and spend more money on defense. I mean, I don't know how they would do that if you don't have the people in the military who can actually deploy and use the weapons that you may use some of that money to buy, to, you know, buy more weapons or expand their weapons. The core force may not be able to deploy them anyway.
If I could chime back in, you know, it's real interesting that 62,000 people, that's about what 8th Air Force lost over the sky in the skies of Germany during World War II. I mean, you know, when you get down to it, it's a minimal number. And what really worries me is not necessarily even the willpower, but the capacity, because not only have they let their militaries get smaller, we've decreased our military size and that, their military industrial base has shrunk just like the U.S. military industrial base is. And, you know, when you factor in human capital, maybe the question isn't should people be willing to spend 2% of GDP. It's what can we do? Some countries may not physically be able to manufacture, recruit, and get to that 2% mark just because of what, you know, Chris said. They don't have the resources to draw upon either materially or politically, being able to tap into their populations to support that. And that's a problem, you know, around the globe, again, in the democracies. So, you know, maybe one of the questions we have to be asking is, what can we do? And then who is not doing that, and who is, in an increasingly dangerous era? We've got to step up. And, you know, they're going to have to pay the bill someplace, and it's not going to be a very happy time in Europe when they cut back social spending to try and defend themselves against Russia.
Yeah, it's one of the other points that Amit makes in the article is, you know, he looks at the demographics of, or the aging of, you know, European societies, and he says, hey, listen, you know, Europe is the oldest it's ever been. And you're looking at more people, you know, they have younger retirement ages than we do here. And so they're retiring and they're going on, you know, a government pension, and there's fewer young people working to pay for that. And so that not only are you, you know, you're not meeting your 2%, you don't have, you know, population sizes are sort of flat because the birth rates are, you know, not, they're not, you need 2.2 for a replenishment rate, and they're in the ones. So the societies are shrinking in size. And so you don't have, you know, you're essentially an upside down pyramid. And so the question is, all those old folks who are on, you know, pensions are going to be consuming more social programs. And so therefore, where are you going to get that money? Well, you're going to cut defense spending. You're going to buy butter, not guns. And so this problem is even, you know, more problematic in the years ahead, because you've got this expanding retired population you've got to fund. And if, you know, one of the options, of course, is higher taxes. But if you look at tax rates in Europe, they're, you know, well over 50% already. And so it's there's only so much blood you can get out of a turnip. And Europe is getting about as much blood as they can before people just stop working altogether because there's no value in it. So Europe has put itself in a very difficult position. And, you know, the only country that has really spent a significant amount of money on its defense and is pretty good is a small country, Greece. And their main concern is not the Russians. Their main concern is another NATO member state.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, they actually have a really good military. And of course, you know, they went bankrupt and got bailed out and all of that. So they have, you know, internal problems, but the Europe is in a fundamentally difficult position. And I'm not sure what their solution is. I don't know have one.
Well, let me jump in, Adam, I think to build upon that is that it really comes down to a matter of prioritization, right? And what is the national interest, and how do we look at that when we're prioritizing whether or not it's butter or bullets? One of the things I found interesting is back in 2007, right? This is right before the great economic collapse. Both the United States GDP and the EU GDP were about the same at $15.5 trillion. Now today, the EU GDP is only at a mere 16.75 trillion, while the American GDP is almost 30. And so there's been a huge amount of growth in these last, 15 or so years that has really, I think, retarded the ability for Europe to expand this kind of discretionary spending, if you want to think of military spending as discretionary. At least it was prior to 2014, I guess. But now, here we are, right? So we've got a Russian invader in 2022. Here it's 2024. We're into the third year of the Ukraine war, and we still have two-thirds of NATO not meeting an obligation they promised in 2014. So is this a threat or not? Is Russia a priority? Defense against Russia, deterring Russia, is this a priority for NATO nations or not? And I think that they are really wrestling with this right now, and they're trying to figure out how if their checkbook can match their needs and where they're going to make those adjustments. Because the reality is, and this is always something that I live by, is sometimes I can't want it more than you do. And in this case, Americans and the American taxpayer can't want it more than the European citizen and the European taxpayer. They've got to want it at least as much as we do to maintain their freedom and liberties. And that means they're going to have to adjust their lifestyles to pay for it.
Well, you know, the GOP has gotten some bad press for not stepping up in Ukraine. Okay. Which is total hogwash, right? As we said, when you start talking about what the U.S. does and what they can contribute and how much we have contributed to a fight in their back door, not just militarily, but economically. But as Curtis pointed out, the EU not only hasn't been meeting their 2% goal, their economy, their GDP just hasn't grown. It's 2% of a much lower growth rate. The one gamma ray or ray of sunshine here, I think, is though that, you know, in 1980, 80% of the world's population suffered from food insecurity. 20% were food secure. Today, 80% are food secure and only 20% aren't. And why is that important? It means the global economy has grown and shifted. And one of the things that comes along with a more prosperous economy is a decline in birth rates. It's very highly correlated. So you are seeing the same sort of demographic changes elsewhere in the world as they become more prosperous. And then the Chinese are in a really rough spot because they have one child policy, and they are one of the few countries that have more male population than female population. So you've got a segment of the Chinese population that'll never be able to get a wife. And they're going to gray much faster than us. But I think that puts Xi on a clock that makes him more dangerous too. So it's sort of a two-edged sword there, but I think we have to think not just about Europe and Russia. We're facing, four bad actors in the world, really. You know, the axis of Iran, North Korea, Russia, and China. And Russia may be the least problematic of those, actually.
I'm not sure I'll buy that.
I think Iran and North Korea are less predictable. And I think Russia's going to end up as the junior partner to China in this whole thing.
Go ahead, Chris.
You know, all of this reminds us of one important element that's often overlooked. The theory is, and kind of, most people think that a nation looks at the threats around them and says, how much will it cost us to defend our nation? But they really don't. I mean, few nations do, and we do at times, but not all the time. Even the United States, we don't ask what does it cost to defend our nation and then go spend that amount of money. We actually ask how much can we afford, or how much are we willing to spend on this? And it's not at all directly related to what the threat might be. And when we're doing well economically, it's obviously easier for us to fund a robust Department of Defense. And it's easier to make those political arguments, and generally the American people are more willing to support that. And we've already indicated that one of the reasons NATO is struggling is because their economies are not nearly as dynamic. We should draw a lesson from that. And by the way, if you think that we can smooth sailing along or smooth, let me try that again. That's how about smoothly along, smooth sailing along. I mean, I'm highly author, by the way, you guys. So
you are.
But if you think we can just sail smoothly along in over the next 10 years with multi-trillion-dollar annual deficits, and then at the end of that catastrophe go, well, yeah, we're going to fund our defense. I mean, they will become mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
Just like Europe, it's difficult for them now because their economy hasn't grown nearly as much as the United States. It's given that us a little bit of luxury, a little bit of leeway to fund our military at a greater rate. But that's going to come to a crushing end if we don't have the foresight and the courage to look at our own finances and go, this is not sustainable. You know, we used to say, oh, we're kicking the can down the road for our kids and our grandkids to deal with our debt. Dude, no way. That's not even close. We'll never get to our grandkids. It's not going to get to our kids. We'll be lucky if we get to 2030, having, as I said, multi-trillion-dollar annual deficits. The last thing this year, and by the way, the last estimate last year was that this wouldn't happen till 2030, 2033. So last year we were told by 2033 we will spend more on interest than our national defense. It didn't happen in 2033. It happened this year, $1 trillion
That's right.
On interest. And it's going to be multi-trillion next year. That's when the rubber hits the road as far as whether we're able to put policies together that allow us to continue to defend our own country.
That's right. And just to remind everybody, so the estimators say that America is borrowing now $1 trillion every 100 days. Think about that. And then we're going to turn around and worry, about how we're going to defend other parts of the world. And again, the $60 billion package for the Ukraine, I would also remind, is larger than the budget of the United States Marine Corps.
Yep.
A couple things. We came to the world's rescue in World War I and World War II, not on the basis of our military might. We had very small militaries at the time. It was on the basis of our economic might. And, to Chris's point, if we don't guard that, everything else, the foundation of the house just falls apart. we have to look to the economy and what we're going to do there. And, you know, I'll throw a spear at the Fed. Inflation is a bad thing. But, you know, ratcheting up interest rates the way they have certainly makes it harder for the United States to refinance its debt.
Let me ask you something, Chris, as a former member of Congress. So, you know, the best way to prevent the United States from going further into debt is a balanced budget amendment. Is there any appetite in Congress for the passage of a balanced budget amendment?
Yes and no. It kind of comes and goes. I hate to say that it's not talked about now like it was, say, 10 years ago and a couple other probably phases previous to that. It's not talked about as much now, which is just ironic since the problem's infinitely greater now than it was 10 years ago. And remember early 1990s, we came within one vote of passing a balanced budget amendment.
Senator Graham's bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so we were close. But I think now, and I hate to say this, I mean, it sounds kind of cynical and it sounds kind of Debbie Downer, but I think a lot of people just look at it like it's just too hard. You know, it just can't be done. If we had a majority of Republicans, we'd probably get it passed. But you got to remember too, there's some moderate Republicans who represent districts in California, New York, and Michigan, who for them, they're probably not going to vote for it. So, I mean, could we do it? Yeah, we almost did once, but people don't talk about it quite like they used to, and that's not a good sign. It's almost like they look at it and go, the problem is just too big. I'm not sure we can take it on, but we'll take it on one way or another.
That's right.
Like I said, we can't ignore this forever. At some point, we will have to confront this problem.
That's right.
We'll have to confront the problem when we're least able to do it. That's just the way the nature of these sorts of things.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the things, if you remember, I think it was Charlie Dunlap who wrote, you know, I think when he was at National War College, I think he wrote an article about the coup of 2013 or something. It was an article like that, you know, and he wrote that in like 2005 or 2007, something like that. And, you know, it was a military coup. And the whole point of the article was, well, what brings about the military coup? And so what I've thought the coup of 2025 might be is when, you know, America's largest lender, that is the Federal Reserve Bank, walks into the president's office and says, Mr. President, we're taking over. You know, you owe us. I mean, how much money do we owe the Federal Reserve? The Federal Reserve, you know, has tens of trillions of dollars. They hold tens of trillions of dollars of U.S. national debt. And of course, they're the reason quantitative easing has made that possible. And so I've always thought that the coup would be the Federal Reserve chairman taking over and telling the president how the country's going to operate from that point forward. And remember, the Federal Reserve is a private entity. Only members of its, you know, board are appointed by the president, but it's a private entity and it controls our, you know, it controls interest rates. It controls banking. It's a really intricate thing that I think would be interesting to see how that all turns out.
Well, they'll do it right before, Rand Paul wants it audited, right? So, exactly. Right before the audit starts, that's when they'll do the coup, right?
Adam, your point there, you know, since we're talking Europe and NATO, they've got the same sort of problem on steroids in Europe because the central bank in Europe is the EU central bank. So you have the EU setting monetary policy. But you have the individual country setting fiscal policy. And, you know, the euro is surprisingly one of the few pegged currencies that has survived. it was a basket of the different currencies in the EU at a certain point in time. And historically, pegged currencies don't last. And Professor DeRosa at Yale, when I was a student there, was talking about, you know, how long could the euro last as a currency because of this disconnect between where monetary and fiscal policy is made. And you've seen some of that. Basically the Germans bailed out the Greeks. The Greeks have a robust defense budget that's being paid for by the Germans. The Italians have a robust social budget, and the Portuguese that are being paid for by the Germans. So in some respects, we're looking to Germany as one of the biggest countries to be a leader there, and they've been busy bailing out their member countries.
Well, I guess you could carry that analogy a little bit farther and say that the Chinese are financing the best ammunition we can send to Ukraine, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the whole thing about the Germans is it's sort of, wasn't that the whole point of NATO? Keep the Russians out, keep the Americans in, and the Germans down. So as long as they can't afford a military because they're paying for everybody else's, then I guess we're doing what it was designed to do. So
what are we complaining about then?
Yeah.
The Germans only want nukes because of politics.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Fellas, we have a stunning reputation as a podcast that only lasts as long as the drive to work or the drive home, and I don't want to break that reputation. So we were a little over time, but it was a good discussion. But I wanted to bring the NIDS view to a conclusion. Any final quick thoughts before we wrap it up?
I'm good.
I think we just gotta not get so excited about political rhetoric, and in the end, cooler heads will prevail. National interests always win out.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, well, Curtis, Kirk, Chris, thanks for joining us on this episode of the NIDS View, and of course, as always, thanks to you, the listeners, and we always want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.